Well, the first trick of preaching on name is finding it. After Micah and before Habakkuk. Mind you, finding Micah and Habakkuk's none too easy either, is it? It's all in the table of contents. Mind you, if your table of contents is not alphabetical, it's still hard to find. But it is there in your Bible, and if it's not, you've got a defective one, and go and get one from our bookstall. Now, we're going to read through our name together in a little while, or rather, Dominic is going to read it to us, reading for us section by section, but even before we read it, so that we can take in what's being said, because it's all three chapters. The temptation is three chapters, therefore three sermons, but the trouble is it's all one long poem. And I think we can cope with the three chapters in one hit, so if we can't, well, we can't, but we're going to find out in a very short time. It's just a couple of pages of the Bible. But before we get that, suppose we can get something of the background, something of the understanding of it. Let's tell you about the background so that you'll know who the players are when they come up in the chapters. The first thing that strikes you in Nahum is that it's not really about Israel, which most of the Bible is about, or Judah. It's really about Assyria and Nineveh. Verse 1, an oracle concerning Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum of Elkoshite. Nineveh was the capital of Assyria, not the capital of Syria, Iraq today, up on the northern reaches of the Tigris River. It's one of the oldest known points of civilization in the world, the largest continuous occupation. It's still occupied today, although not under that name. It once, at this stage in the history, the time that Nahum's about, etc., was a massive city. The wall was that went around the city was 12 kilometres long. It was a very large city. It had huge dams and canals. One of its waterwork canals ran for 45 kilometres. I mean, we're talking about a highly sophisticated civilization. Their favourite god was Ishtar, that is, the goddess of war. Their symbols were the ravenous lions, and conquest was their reputation. In the 8th and 7th century BC, they are at their ascendancy, and their power stretched from the Tigris River right across the Middle East and across to Egypt, for they conquered Egypt and therefore were the superpower of that period of time, the largest empire of that time. One of their conquests is Thebes. Thebes was the capital city of Egypt at the time. It was a magnificent city, vast with temples and palaces, and with wealth that they had ripped off Africa and Asia. In 663 BC, the Assyrians lay siege to Thebes, conquered it, and ripped off all its possessions. The king who did it, whose unpronounceable name I will not pronounce, wrote of his destruction of Thebes in these terms. From Thebes I carried away booty, heavy and beyond counting, silver, gold, precious stones, his entire personal possessions, linen garments with multicoloured trimmings, fine horses, inhabitants, male and female. I pulled two high obelisks, cast of shining bronze, the weight of which was 2,500 talents, standing at the door of the temple. I pulled them out of their bases and took them to Assyria. I carried off from Thebes heavy booty beyond counting. I made Egypt and Nubia feel my weapons bitterly and celebrated my triumph with full hands, and safely I returned to Nineveh, the city where I exercise my rule. Egypt, in all its wealth and power and splendor, was just booty for the Assyrians. When the Assyrians conquered, they took it all. And so Nineveh itself became the capital of the world. 8th, 7th century, 663, the conquest of Thebes, before Christ. Now, Israel was a small-time bit player in the history of the world at that stage. In the cross-currents of superpower rivalry, Israel's just one of those little states that gets in the way sometimes. In the 9th century, it's already in conflict with Assyria and paying tribute to Assyria. And of course, as Assyria grows in strength through the 8th century, so does the increase in paying of tribute and the danger to the Israelites of Assyrian conquest. In 722 BC, Israel had taken on Assyria and was destroyed. That is, Israel, I'm talking of the 10 northern tribes, for at this stage in the history of the people of God, they had split. The 10 northern tribes being called Israel, the 2 southern tribes being called Judah. And the 10 northern tribes of Israel were destroyed by the Assyrians. 722 BC, 50 or so years before the conquest, 60 years or so before the conquest of Thebes. The 2 southern tribes called Judah escaped the Assyrian destruction. Sennacherib was an Assyrian king who came down and laid siege to Jerusalem. But strangely to him and to the Greek historians, he couldn't conquer Jerusalem. Not really strangely to the people of Jerusalem, they knew God was on their side, but they had great relief when Sennacherib went home. Throughout the 7th century, Assyria was dominant world power, and Judah was just a small vassal state of the Assyrian Empire. They paid tribute in order to exist. If they ever stopped paying tribute, they ran the risk of Assyrian wrath. In the year 612 BC, the end of the 7th century, in other words, Nineveh fell. It was a bolt out of the blue. No one expected it any more than they really expected Thebes to fall. In fact, it was a little bit more unexpected because it fell to a new power that really hadn't flexed its muscles much up until this time. The new power was Babylon. Not from Egypt, but from the Euphrates River, just on the other side of the valley of the Tigris-Euphrates. Babylon rose up very sharply, very quickly, and conquered its master, its overlord, Assyria. Shortly afterwards, Babylon came to Jerusalem and destroyed Jerusalem and took Judah into slavery. So here in Nahum, we're writing of the time when Israel has been defeated, Judah is still alive as a vassal of Assyria, and Assyrian power is enormous. It's written after the events of the destruction of Thebes, so it's written after 663, and it's written before the destruction of Nineveh, 612. So it's in that period of time, from somewhere between 663 and 612 BC, we hear of what is going to happen to Nineveh and the prophecy of its coming destruction. Well, now let's turn to the passage itself, giving you the kind of political background at the time, and go work through our way through the book in different sections of reading. Dominic, why don't you read for us the first 7 verses, brother?
An oracle concerning Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and maintains his wrath against his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. The Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. His way is in the whirlwind and the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and dries it up. He makes all the rivers run dry. Bashan and Carmel wither, and the blossoms of Lebanon fade. The mountains quake before him, and the hills melt away. The earth trembles at his presence, the world and all who live in it. Who can withstand his indignation? Who can endure his fierce anger? His wrath is poured out like fire. The rocks are shattered before him. The Lord is good, a refuge in times of trouble. He cares for those who trust in him.
The title tells us not much more than we already see. We don't know where Elkosh was, and we see no particular symbolism in Elkosh, seeing we don't even know, there's no other reference to it. We don't know anything about Elkosh. It just tells you where he came from. But it's about Nineveh. And then verses 2 to 7 spell out for us the character of God. So far, the implications for Nineveh are not being spelt out. That's going to come in the rest of the book. But certain things are said about God. This is the God who was the one who met Moses, the one who is slow to anger, the one who will not allow the guilty to go unpunished,
the one who is jealous and avenging, the God of the covenant. But he is also the God of creation. From the second half of verse 3 down to verse 5, he is the one whom the whole world is responsible. That is, the God of the covenant, who judges in anger and justice, is also the creator of the universe. And so no one, verse 6, can oppose such a God. Who can withstand his indignation? I mean, the God of all the universe, who has created and who rules the universe, Bashan and Carmel were two parts of Palestine which were particularly given to rich pasture lands. And so Bashan and Carmel will wither, and the blossoms of the Lebanon, again, the Levant, the Lebanon was a very rich area, so you've got great trees and great beauty in their blossoms. They'll fade at just the opposition of this God. This God rules the universe. The mountains quake, the hills. If you oppose him, who will stand? Rhetorically meaning, of course, no one. But verse 7 tells you the other side of the character of God. He is good and a refuge in times of trouble. He cares for those who trust in him. But just as he is the God who is powerful in vengeance and anger, he is a God who rescues. Now, verses 2 to 7 we're going to come back to right at the end, because they are the great theological statement of the book of Nahum. But it's not just a theological statement, because verses 2 to 7 sets for us the scene of the action of God. God is not just theoretically angry. God's anger is put into action. And you hear that anger put into action with the destruction of Nineveh, and you see the goodness of God in the rescue of Judah. I bet you read for us verses 8 to 15. Thanks.
With an overwhelming flood, he will make an end of Nineveh. He will pursue his foes into darkness. Whatever they plot against the Lord, he will bring to an end. Trouble will not come a second time. They will be entangled among thorns and drunk from their wine. They will be consumed like dry stubble. From you, O Nineveh, has one come forth who plots evil against the Lord and counsels wickedness. This is what the Lord says. Although they have allies and are numerous, they will be cut off and pass away. Although I have afflicted you, O Judah, I will afflict you no more. Now I will break their yoke from your neck and tear your shackles away. The Lord has given a command concerning you, Nineveh. You will have no descendants to bear your name. I will destroy the carved images and cast idols that are in the temple of your gods. I will prepare your grave, for you are vile. Look, there on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good news, who proclaims peace. Celebrate your festivals, O Judah, and fulfill your vows. No more will the wicked invade you. They will be completely destroyed.
On the one hand, Nineveh, the enemies of God, are to be destroyed. On the other hand, Judah, the people of God, are to be rescued, to be saved, to be liberated. Just a point of Bible reading that I draw your attention to. If you look at verse 8, you see the word Nineveh has two little kind of square brackets at the bottom of your New International Version text. If you're working from some other text, I don't know what you've got there in front of you, but you'll see the same kind of brackets occur on the word Nineveh in verse 14, or the same brackets occur on Nineveh in verse 11, or on Judah in verse 12. Those little brackets, the translators are doing the right thing for us. They're indicating that the word is not in the Hebrew text. And they are saying, to make sense of this sentence, you've got to read it as applying to Judah or applying to Nineveh. And so we've put the word in so that you will make sense of what the passage is saying, but we're indicating to you by little brackets that it's not there in the original. Very helpful that they've done that to you. You'll notice, for example, in verse 15, there is no bracket around the word O Judah, because in verse 15 it is there in the Hebrew. That's what the brackets are about. And they're important so that we know what words are in the Bible and which bits the translators are imposing to help bring out the meaning. I think they're right on this occasion, on those impositions. I tried reading it without those words, and the things make sense without the words, but it's Nineveh that is in mind, or Judah that is in mind, exactly where they say it is in mind, and so it's a reasonable thing to bring it out, the meaning out for us like that, especially when you put the little brackets in to warn people that you're doing it. On the one hand, Nineveh is to be destroyed. On the other hand, Judah is to be rescued. That is, God's anger is not just theoretically. He's going to destroy. But its impact is a little lost on us, because it is actually unimaginable for them. It is like saying, I am going to destroy the United States. I mean, Assyria was the greatest power of the world at the time. And when you live in a period of time, you can't really imagine easily that the greatest power of your time is going to be knocked out in a blow, that somehow it's going to be just destroyed in a moment. It's hard to imagine that is possible. You see, we can say, well, back in the 8th century, in the 7th century, in the 9th century, but I'm now talking of a period of 300 years. I mean, America hasn't been the greatest nation in the world over 300 years. Its ascendancy has only been of recent times, and yet it is unthinkable that next year it will be wiped off the face of the earth. And that is the kind of thing that is being said here. And a little nation like Judah, who is under the shadow and threat of Assyria, was going to be rescued. Cuba, Nicaragua, something like that. Its problems are going to be solved because Assyria, because the United States is going to be torn down. It's hard to believe it, really, isn't it? And it would have been very hard for them to believe that was going to happen. Chapter 2 describes what is going to happen inside Nineveh. Chapter 2 is about the siege and sack of the great city of Nineveh. Let me read the first 10 verses for us this time, please.
An attacker advances against you, Nineveh. Guard the fortress, watch the road, brace yourselves. Marshal all your strength. The Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob, like the splendor of Israel, though destroyers have laid them waste and have ruined their vines. The shields of his soldiers are red, the warriors are clad in scarlet. The metal on the chariots flashes on the day that they are made ready. The spears of pine are brandished. The chariots storm through the streets, rushing back and forth through the squares. They look like flaming torches. They dart about like lightning. He summons his picked troops, yet they stumble on their way. They dash to the city wall. The protective shield is put in place. The river gates are thrown open and the palace collapses. It is decreed that the city be exiled and carried away. Its slave girls moan like doves and beat upon their breasts. Nineveh is like a pool, and its water is draining away. Stop, stop, they cry, but no one turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. The supply is endless, the wealth from all its treasures. She is pillaged, plundered, stripped. Hearts melt, knees give way, bodies tremble, every face grows pale.
Striking imagery, isn't it? It really is very modern language. Hearts melt, knees give way, bodies tremble. Like the modern newspaper, you don't need to have verbs and sentences anymore. You just have statements like that that grab you. Chapter 3, even more so. The siege will see the destruction. Verse 2, you'll notice Israel is in sight. Israel is to be restored. The nation that Assyria has wiped out is somehow going to come back. The destruction of the city and the siege, it gets caught up in with this business about the river gates. The river gates are thrown open, the palace collapses. A bit of a funny phrase, and yet from Greek historians we know that the destruction of Nineveh did involve, indeed, the breaking down of dam walls and the flooding of the city. That the city was built on the river, not the river Tigris itself, on the river Husar, and it actually broke its banks and came through at that time, and it was part of the military campaign. The destruction of the city is one that has no mercy, no pity. The people are carted off into slavery. That is, what is being described here is a great reversal. The mighty, the proud, falling and stumbling. Nineveh, the wild, ravaging lion of the ancient world, is to be destroyed and ravaged. They've lived by the sword, they're about to die by the sword, because God is against them. That's the conclusion of chapter 2. That's the argument of chapter 2, verses 11 to 13. Thanks, Dominic.
Where now is the lion's den, the place where they fed their young, where the lion and lioness went, and the cubs with nothing to fear? The lion killed enough for his cubs and strangled the prey for his mate, filling his lairs with the kill and his dens with the prey. I am against you, declares the Lord Almighty. I will burn up your chariots in smoke, and the sword will devour your young lions. I will leave you no prey on the earth. The voices of your messengers will no longer be heard.
I am against you. And so the lion is indeed to be destroyed. Chapter 3 starts off with a taunt over Nineveh. Nineveh, the city of blood. And in this taunt is a description of the tyrannies of any generation and of any century. Ours is a century that has been full of tyrannies and oppression, and of millions of people being killed by the stupidity of tyrants and their wickedness. Nineveh was like it. How about you hear the first 7 verses of the woe that is on Nineveh?
Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims. The crack of whips, the clatter of wheels, galloping horses and jolting chariots, charging cavalry, flashing swords and glittering spears. Many casualties, piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over the corpses, all because of the wanton lust of a harlot, alluring the mistress of sorceries, who enslaved nations by her prostitution and peoples by her witchcraft. I am against you, declares the Lord Almighty. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. I will pelt you with filth. I will treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. All who see you will flee from you and say, Nineveh is in ruins. Who will mourn for her? Where can I find anyone to comfort you?
Who mourns the fall of Adolf Hitler or of Joseph Stalin? Who mourns the millions that they were responsible for killing? People mourn those who were killed, but nobody mourns now the loss of those men or of Mao Zedong or of Pol Pot. The terrible massacre of the Armenians at the beginning of this century, the millions, the countless number of bodies piled into common graves by people who ruled with tyranny and oppression. But it's as old as Nineveh. Nineveh was the city of blood. Nineveh was like all those dreadful oppressive tyrants. It was likened to a seductive prostitute, enslaving other nations by its witchcraft and sorcery, by the evil power that it extended. And so the judgment of God comes on it. The judgment again of verse 5 in chapter 3, which is just like chapter 2, verse 13, I am against you, and no one will mourn you. Your shame, your contempt will be seen by all. No one's going to be sorry when it happens. This is straightforward for us, really. After all, thousands of years have passed. And who would think about Nineveh today? But at the time, who would think that the mighty Nineveh is going to get its comeuppance? Who would think that the mighty Nineveh should now be held up to public ridicule and public scorn and shame? But friends, it's like that even in our own. What a last year or two we've been through. The Berlin Wall come down, Iraq and being at war with us, Russian turnovers that have taken place there, the liberations of Czechoslovakia. I mean, who would have imagined 3-4 years ago that the face of the European map would be anything like it is, well, who knows what it is anymore. Who would like to be in school today and draw a map of Europe? I suppose it's a good time. They could never mark you wrong. I mean, it's got one side to it. I mean, it's all changing so quickly, and it can change so quickly, and it did change so quickly, and you should know that it can change quickly like that because you were the conquerors of Thebes. Chapter 3, verses 8 to 11. Thanks, Dominic.
Are you better than Thebes, situated on the Nile, with water around her? The river was her defence, the waters her wall. Cush and Egypt were her boundless strength. Put and Libya were among her allies. Yet she was taken captive and went into exile. Her infants were dashed to pieces at the head of every street. Lots were cast for her nobles, and all her great men were put in chains. You too will become drunk. You will go into hiding and seek refuge from the enemy.
Kingdoms come, kingdoms go. And the Assyrians were responsible for destroying one of the greatest kingdoms of all. If anybody should have realized that a kingdom was very fragile, that a city of wealth was very fragile, the Assyrians should have, because they destroyed the fragility of that mighty city of Thebes, built on a river also, thinking that it had its defense. It couldn't be starved out like other cities were starved out, because they had their river. They always had, but they were able to overcome Thebes. And you, Nineveh, you too will be overcome. And what you did to Thebes will be done to you. And so the inevitability of the doom of Nineveh is spelt out in the last section of this whole book of prophecy. That although they've got merchants more than the Japanese, though they've got public servants more than Canberra, they cannot possibly survive, because merchants and public servants in the end are of no use to anyone. Chapter 3, verses 12. Now, you're listening to this section, aren't you? Chapter 3, verses 12 to 19. Thanks, Dominic.
All your fortresses are like fig trees with their first ripe fruit. When they are shaken, the figs fall into the mouth of the eater. Look at your troops. They are all women. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire has consumed their bars. Draw water for the siege. Strengthen your defences. Work the clay. Tread the mortar. Repair the brickwork. There the fire will devour you. The sword will cut you down and like grasshoppers consume you. Multiply like grasshoppers. Multiply like locusts. You have increased the number of your merchants till they are more than the stars of the sky. But like locusts, they strip the land and then fly away. Your guards are like locusts, your officials like swarms of locusts that settle in the walls on a cold day, but when the sun appears, they fly away and no one knows where. O king of Assyria, your shepherds slumber, your nobles lie down to rest. Your people are scattered on the mountains with no one to gather them. Nothing can heal your wound. Your injury is fatal. Everyone who hears the news about you claps his hands at your fall. For who has not felt your endless cruelty?
See, it looks strong. Got fortress, got walls, got an army, got merchants, got public servants. They're the ones, I take it, the officials of verse 17. It's got everything going for it, but the army, it's just a bunch of women. No way they're going to stand and fight when the chips are down. That's not an army that's going to be helpful to you. And your defences, well, they're all built on the river. They're actually going to cave in when the flood comes. And your merchants, oh, merchants are all the same, all down through the ages. They're always around when the picking's there, but as soon as they pick the place clean, they're going to move on elsewhere. The merchants aren't going to stand and fight for your sake. People who make money in Wall Street are the people who leave as soon as there's any danger to be seen. In fact, so terrified are they of danger and falls that their computers are all geared to sell, sell, sell at the slightest drop of the market. It's an automatic process that can put us all into bankruptcy. And their officials, well, they're everywhere. They swarm like locusts on the wall on a cold day. It's Canberra. But as soon as the sun comes out, whoosh, they're all gone. Can't see one anywhere. You're doomed. You are doomed, O king of Assyria. Nothing can heal your wound. It's a fatal injury. And when people see your death, do you know what they're going to do? They're going to stand up and cheer. They're going to clap. Because there is no one who hasn't felt your endless cruelty. That's an awful verse right at the end of verse 19, but it lets you know what Assyria is like, doesn't it? Endless cruelty. Well, there you go. There's the book of Nahum read. It's a fun thing to come to church to hear, isn't it? Light entertainment on a Sunday evening. It's one of those heavy parts of the Old Testament. Now, look, Christians are really upset and uptight about their Old Testament. And so they should be, because these days Old Testament knowledge is sadly lacking in the Christian community generally. And when we come to read a book like Nahum, it's not a hard book to read, really, is it? I mean, it looks a bit hard. You know, you can get caught on the first verse when you see the word Elkoshite, and 6 hours of dictionary research later, you discover that no one knows what it means. You think, well, I'll have a go at verse two and see if I do any better there, you see. And it can be a bit off-putting in places, but it's actually fairly simple. Once you've found out who Nineveh were and Thebes, I think they're the only bits of background that you really know. I mean, you might like to find out who Put and Libya were, but it's just a way of saying that the Theban Empire was a very big empire. They had lots of allies around about it. It's a straightforward passage, really, in verses 2 to 7 of chapter 1. The God of all the universe is angry and jealous, and he is going to rescue his people and destroy his enemies. And then the rest of the book is about the destruction of the enemies, Nineveh in particular. But we're sitting 2,000, 2,500 years later on the other side of the world, and Nineveh is just a mound these days with a few shepherds living in it. What is the Bible saying to us now? What do we make now as a result of this reading of our lives, now that we live beyond the age of Jesus Christ and we live in a different world and don't feel particularly threatened by Nineveh anyway? There are five things I've listed on your outline that I'm going to spend a few moments rattling through. Five areas of Christian truth and understanding, viewing the world, that are reflected in Nahum and come out of Nahum for us. The first is a background thing about lies and deceit. Lies and deceit aren't mentioned much here in the book of Nahum, although it's a warning to Nineveh about the lies and deceits that they believe. Lies and deceits are of native breath to us. We all know how to lie from our very... What is the Bible saying to us now? What do we make now as a result of this reading of our lives, now that we live beyond the age of Jesus Christ and we live in a different world and don't feel particularly threatened by Nineveh anyway? There are five things I've listed on your outline that I'm going to spend a few moments rattling through. Five areas of Christian truth and understanding, viewing the world, that are reflected in Nahum and come out of Nahum for us. The first is a background thing about lies and deceit. Lies and deceit aren't mentioned much here in the book of Nahum, although it's a warning to Nineveh about the lies and deceits that they believe. Lies and deceits are of native breath to us. We all know how to lie from our very earliest sentences. We do not need anybody to teach us, because our father, the devil, is the father of all lies, and therefore we all tell lies. And what's even more stupid, we all believe lies. And what is even more stupid, we all believe our own lies. Now, that is really dumb, isn't it? But yet, after a while of telling them often enough, we come to believe them ourselves. Our political leaders have told us that you cannot govern this country without telling lies. Caught in telling us blatant and obviously self-interested lies, they have been astonished that we in the community have been upset by being lied to, by saying that everybody does it. Indeed, you cannot be in government without it. It's a pathetic state of this nation, isn't it? And so we constantly try to deceive each other. We're constantly trying to deceive God. And we even try and deceive ourselves. In the Iraq war earlier this year, I saw some people on the television, of course, who were in Jordan, and they were cheering greatly as the Scud missiles headed over to Israel. But what was sad, amusing, bemusing to me, it couldn't relate to it at all, was this group of men facing up to the cameras saying that they were certain, and you could see they were, and they were just average people, not part of the propaganda machine, they were certain that Iraq would win the war very quickly. It was hard to imagine how what they were hearing and what we were hearing was about the same event. We were getting all the information about the continuous build-up of the Allied forces that's possibly as big a build-up as there has been in the history of mankind, to obliterate this little nation called Iraq. I mean, it might have taken a long time to happen. As it turned out, it took almost no time to happen, did it? When they actually went in, having bombed the place and obliterated some how many thousands of men, we'll never know. But here were these group of people who were genuinely and utterly convinced that Iraq would win and would win quickly, and that the whole world was going to somehow be put down by Saddam Hussein. Presumably Saddam Hussein himself totally underestimated the power of the armies and nations that were raging up against him. For he had many, many times, many, many months in which to negotiate some kind of peace, to withdraw something from Kuwait, to actually save something of his nation and his people and his own empire and kingdom and power. And yet he seemed to be able to think that somehow he could tough it out against the whole world. And so people often believe in absolute foolishness. We think that we can approach God on the basis that he won't ever hurt us. After all, I've done nothing wrong. And God couldn't wage war with me. I mean, he's a pacifist, isn't he? He's a God of peace. So therefore, there's no way he'd wage war against me. And if he did, well, he wouldn't really destroy me, would he? I mean, he's powerless to do anything to me. In fact, if he cared to come down here and ask me some hard questions, I've got some hard questions to ask him. I want to know about this and that and why he's allowed such and such and so and so. I mean, I could hold God. I could have a really good... Job is like that, isn't he? Job wants God to come down so that he and God can have a chat about who's in the wrong and who's in the right in this situation. It is believing a foolishness. It is believing a stupidity, the lies and deceit of our own morality and of God's weakness. It lies behind Nahum, and Nahum is warning Nineveh not to think that it is safe and secure in a fight against God. It's a warning that modern people, Western people, need to hear today, isn't it? For most people in Australia think they can sin with impunity, that God, if he is ever interested in it, would never take any action. Anyway, it's got nothing to do with him. What I do in the privacy of my own life's got nothing to do with God, my maker, my owner, my ruler, my judge. That's all irrelevant. And even if he doesn't like what I've got to do, well, he can take a running jump, because who's God anyway? It doesn't matter very much. It's a perception of lies, as stupid and as foolish as it comes. Mount St. Helens blew up, when was it? 1984, 1983, 2, something like that. In the Time magazine, and there was this interview of a man who was a hermit kind of character living in a mountain shack on Mount St. Helens, and the local people, the local government authorities tried to get him to leave his shack. And he said that he wouldn't leave his shack, he was going to stay there, because... He and the mountain knew each other well, and there's no way that the mountain was going to hurt him, because he and the mountain were good friends. That's the last recorded sentence of that man. The area of the mountain that his shack lived on doesn't actually exist anymore. It was just blown into smithereens. There is a certain kind of stupidity in the lies and the deceptions of people's heads, isn't there? You think you can attack God? You think you'll survive if God is against you? Second thing I want to say about a biblical view that you see in Nahum is it talks about the anger and jealousy of God. You see it there in that opening section, verse 2, the Lord is jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes his vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and maintains his wrath against his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power, and the Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. That doesn't sound like gentle Jesus, meek and mild, does it? You think, what kind of God have we got? It is the God of the Old Testament, whereas the God of the New Testament somehow loving and kind. That's nonsense. That's balderdash. The person who uses the word hell more than any other person in the Bible is Jesus. The word hell only occurs about 13 times, and 12 of them on the lips of Jesus. No, the Old Testament and the New Testament can say the same things about God in his loving kindness and God in his avenging justice and wrath. And here it kicks off on the avenging justice and wrath of God. So we've got to do something about this anger and jealousy business, haven't we? What is it saying to us about it? We think of anger and jealousy as bad things, don't we? They are usually negative emotions and responses to the situations of life, and they express our sinful nature. In the list of the sinful nature and the works of the sinful nature in Galatians chapter 5, anger and jealousy are amongst that list. And we're told in the Epistle of James that the anger of man does not work the righteous life that God desires. Our anger, our jealousy is usually negative. But anger and jealousy can be good. Indeed, anger and jealousy are necessary things if you're going to live a righteous and godly life. Because anger and jealousy are an expression of love. What is the opposite of love? You can say hate. That's one way of seeing the opposite of love. You could see, some people would say anger. Some would say jealousy. But the real opposite of love is indifference. If I love something, it matters enormously to me. And if something doesn't matter to me at all, then I don't love it. It's indifference is the opposite of love. Your spouse is having an affair with somebody else. Well, that's all right, I don't mind. What does that mean? Because I don't give a fig about my spouse, doesn't it? How can you love your spouse and happily have your spouse having an affair with someone else? Someone's giving your children drugs, addicting them to some chemical. Yeah. Privacy of their own body, they can do whatever they like. I don't care. It's all right. I've got a few more kids at home too. If you like, I'll give you the phone number. What's the opposite of love? It's indifference. If you love your children, how can you say, well, I don't care if they take drugs or don't take drugs. It's all the same to me. You see, if you love your children and your children are being tempted and pushed and pressured in any shape or fashion to become drug addicts, then you should be angry, shouldn't you? Not to be angry, not to be jealous for their safety, is a defect in your character. To be angry and jealous about your spouse having an affair is absolutely righteous. You should be angry. You should be jealous, because if you love your spouse, then you'll be jealous for your relationship. And you'll be angry at the abuse. Anger and jealousy can be very good things. My problem and your problem is that we're so sinful, we get them all botched up. And we get angry and jealous at the wrong time over the wrong things. And we express our anger and jealousy in the wrong ways. We are rarely slow to anger. That's what God is, if you'll notice there. He is slow to anger, verse 3. It sounds funny, that phrase, slow to anger. What does that mean? He mulls it over. Deep-seated resentment building up. No, no. The image that is actually got there of slow to anger means that he's not temperamental. That his anger is measured in justice is the idea of slow to anger. When you're angry, are you slow to anger? Now, most of our anger is very quick, isn't it? The car is just cut in front of me on Parramatta Road. I'm angry. They're getting in my way. I'm getting frustrated by somebody who's behind a governmental office unwilling to answer my inquiries. I've been on this telephone for 25 minutes and I'm still listening to Muzak. And every now and then they interrupt Muzak by telling me what a wonderful department they are and all the good things they're doing for me. And then put me back to more Muzak. I am angry. Might be 25 minutes, but I've been angry for the whole 24 and a half of them. I am quick to anger. And my anger is a temperament, is a losing of myself and a losing of my temper. But that's not what's being spoken about here. God is not temperamental. He doesn't get out of bed on the wrong side sometime and feels lousy today. No, no. God's anger is just. God's anger is just. Slow to anger will not leave the guilty unpunished. It is the kind of anger which says, knowing all the events and the effects and the causes, knowing all the situation of what Adolf Hitler did to the people of Europe, I want to say that man deserved to be punished. I am righteously angry with what was done. It's got nothing to do with quick temper. It's got to do with an evaluation of people mattering. They concern. Millions of Jews can be just sacrificed for no other reason than the ideology of a man like Adolf Hitler. You should be angry. And if you are not angry, then you don't care. For if you care, you'll be angry. Nothing losing your temper. So this passage tells us a lot about God. God is the creator of all things and the ruler of all things, who holds all the nations accountable to him, even nations that ignore him, especially nations that ignore him. That is, God is not just the God of Israel. God is the God of Assyria as well, who doesn't even acknowledge him, but who in their actions are doing such evil and corrupt things. God is angry with all. And his love, and therefore his anger and jealousy, is not just a theory, but an action. It's not just that God theoretically loves and God theoretically is angry. God's anger flashed out at these people and destroyed this wicked empire. For God is no unilateral pacifist. God will not let the guilty go unpunished. Verse 3. You learn something of the character of God in this book, especially this opening section. But notice how his anger differs from ours. It is always just. Wrong should be punished. That is, God is a retributive God. He gives people what they deserve. He's not like us. We are utilitarians. We give people what we think may be helpful. We don't know what's going to be helpful. In fact, every piece of evidence we've got will show us that prisons are not very helpful at all. But we still give it to them, although we don't call them prisons anymore. We call them departments of corrective services. We're trying to help people get better. We want to view people as sick, and somehow we can improve them by locking them up. That God punishes people because they're guilty. He gives people what they deserve. And so God's anger is under the control of his justice, just as his justice is rightly fueled by his anger. Which brings us to the fifth and final point. That is love. God is also loving. And love is not incompatible with justice and anger. In fact, it's just the other side of the same coin. Love enables the compassion and mercy that is illustrated in the rescue of Judah and the restoration of Israel that is being promised. Now, all this compassion, this mercy, this justice, this God who is the ruler of the universe, this anger and jealousy, all this is, of course, the necessary background to understand the death of Jesus Christ. For in the cross, we see these things all taking place. In the death of Jesus, we see the anger and jealousy of God over the sinful destruction of his world and his people. We see God taking this anger in seriousness so that the penalty must be paid. God has not just opened wide heaven and says everybody can just come in, it doesn't matter what anybody's done, doesn't matter. What people have done does matter. What you have done to other people, what other people have done to you does matter. Immorality, injustice, untruth does matter. It matters enormously to God. It matters so much to God that he was willing to punish it. But we matter to God so much that he was willing to bear our punishment. For God is able not only to punish, but to rescue from punishment. 2 Peter chapter 2 discusses that. That God can rescue from punishment while at the same time punish. And nowhere more clearly do you see it than the cross of Jesus. The God of Nahum is the God of the New Testament. The God who is angry with sin and who will judge the world, even people who won't acknowledge him, especially people who don't acknowledge him. He will destroy those that he is against. But his anger against the sin of the world is not only to be seen when he comes in the last day, like 2 Peter 3 discusses, but is seen in the cross of Jesus, where Jesus bore the wrath of God for us, that we who can be the friends of God can be rescued. And so are you one of the foes of God or one of the friends of God? See verse 7 of chapter 1, the Lord is good, a refuge in time of troubles, for he cares for those who trust in him. The people of Judah who trusted in him were rescued when the whole world fell apart. Are you one of the friends of God who trust in him for refuge? Or are you one of the foes of God who thinks somehow that the world's lies are true, that you'll be able to oppose God and get away with it, that you'll be able to stand up to God like a man and put him in his place? I think it's called whistling in the dark, isn't it? For the God of all the world calls all the world to turn back to him. For he has died for our sins, and he is coming again to judge each one of us for what we have done in his righteous anger. The Assyrians were reminded about Thebes. I'd remind you about Nineveh or Babylon or Adolf Hitler. Or the list goes on and on of people who thought they could live in unrighteousness and in power forever. It's a lie of the devil.